Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. Tonight, my returning guest is science writer Joe Marchant, PhD. We are talking about her new book, In Search of Now, The Science of the Present Moment. Joe, welcome back to the show. I had to have you back to talk about this book.
Hi, thank you for having me back.
This book sort of increasingly becomes more bizarre as the chapters go on, and which I loved about this book. And I want to talk about the chapter Bursts of Creation. Now, talk about the thought experiment suggested by quantum physicist John Archibald Wheeler in the 1970s.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite experiments. So it started as a thought experiment. It was since done in practice, but he suggested a variant on the famous double slit experiment, which
you might have to explain that one first.
Maybe if we start with that. So this is a classic experiment that's at the heart of quantum physics. It shows some of the weirdness and mystery around quantum physics, why it's so difficult to explain. So essentially, you have photons, or could be electrons, any little particles that you're firing at a screen that has two slits in it, and then you're picking up on a detector screen where they hit. And essentially, if they're passing through the two slits at once, you get an interference pattern on the detector screen at the end. If you sort of closed off one of those slits, they'd just be passing through one, so you'd just see a little bright spot where everything is landing, essentially. But the weird thing is that just whether or not you check for photons, whether or not you're checking which slit they're going through, essentially determines the path that they appear to take.
So it's whether they're a particle or a wave.
Yeah, so if you check which one they go through, then they just seem to go through one, they just act like a particle, and they land on the other side. And if you don't check, it's as if it was a wave. It's as if it's gone through both slits at once, and you see this interference pattern. And you see that interference pattern even if you're only sending one photon at a time. So it's as if that one photon has suddenly become wave-like and gone through both slits and somehow interfered with itself. And it's just that decision of whether or not you're checking that seems to make the difference. So this is kind of what's weird. It's like, well, is it a particle? Is it a wave? Why should the way we look, why should whether we're checking make any difference to how these photons or whatever particles you're using, why should that make any difference to how they behave? And then what John Wheeler said, so this is a delayed choice version of this experiment. So what he said was, well, how about if we didn't even make the decision of whether to check until right at the end of the photon's journey? So it's already traveled through the slits, and then we'll just decide at the very last minute whether we're going to check or not and see if that makes a difference. And he predicted that it would still affect the photon's journey. And
that's a very weird idea. That's a very weird idea, Joe. That means that the measurement of how the photons traveled through the apparatus, the decisions that were made now, were affecting the past?
Will change supposedly a journey that has already been made. And the reason he suggested this was because physicists were essentially arguing, and we still have the same kind of split today. With quantum physics, you can go, there's lots of different interpretations, but there's two main ways that you can go. You can either say, well, quantum physics is really weird. It kind of looks as though the decisions that we're making are affecting what we're finding. But that can't be what's really happening. There just must be some sort of weird version of reality out there, but it's still, we've still got there's still a pre-existing solid reality out there. Our measurements are you know, nothing to do with it. It's just the, it might seem that way to us, but that's not really what's happening. Or you can say, oh, well, we're going to take this seriously and say, well, maybe there isn't a pre-existing reality out there. Maybe what we do and the decisions we make and the measurements we make do matter and do make a difference for what's out there. So somehow you need that measurement. You need us looking, us taking that action for there to be an answer. And this is what John Wheeler thought. So he thought that there wasn't, the reason that we can't pin things down until we look is because there literally isn't a solid thing there until we look.
And whoa. Okay. So that means there's no physical reality other than what we perceive?
He thought that it's like a co-creation that you, right. It's not that it's just us in our own heads and we're just dreaming the world, okay. But that somehow you needed that interaction. So to perceive, say, a particle, that we're playing a role in bringing that particle into being. Like, we're not doing the whole job. You know, there's clearly a sort of a reality that we can, that we can interact with. We can be surprised by, wow, things, or, you know, we can get things wrong, but it's not like there's a solid answer out there. There's not like a little marble sitting there that you just look and find out where it is. The photon literally doesn't, you know, exist in that sense until you look. You have to ask the question to get an answer. And so that, because he thought that, he said, well, if that's the case, then that photon's past must also not exist until we look. So he said, I bet you, if you wait and you don't even make the decision until after the journey has been made, you will still see that your decision made the difference. And decades later, they managed to work out a way of doing this experiment where essentially that is what you do, and found precisely what he predicted, that apparently, yeah, you make this decision right at the end of the experiment whether or not to look, but that is enough to change the apparent way that this photon has behaved, whether it traveled just one route like a particle or whether it traveled both routes like a wave. But, and obviously you still not everyone goes, oh, okay, that means there's no solid reality out there beyond us. There's, well, different interpretations, but it means that whatever reality is, it's something very different to what we would normally think of.
But is there a difference between what happens on a particle level and what happens on the macro level? Because that always seems to be one of the challenges. Is because, granted, I'm totally behind quantum theory. I understand that that's how the world works. But there seems to be something that breaks down between what happens on the particle level and what happens on the macro level. And that's one of the things that the quantum theorists are searching for right now, is how that, how the micro translates into the macro. And not only that, that experiment that Wheeler thought of really creates all sorts of wild paradoxes. I mean, does this mean the past is never dead?
Well, exactly. That's what William Holder famously said, didn't he? The past is never dead. It's not even past. This is essentially a version of that. And that experiment, just to say, has been repeated lots and lots of different times with photons, with electrons, with entire atoms. They've done it with photons bouncing off satellites in space. So you've actually got quite a long journey that then they make, wow, the decision right at the end. And they always find the same thing. So that result in itself is a very, very robust result that has been replicated by lots of different people. So you need to find some way of explaining it. In terms of the macro level, I mean, it is interesting because it depends about how you think about the past, really. You know, we have this idea that there's this linear timeline, right, that, you know, the universe started in a big bang and it's just been sort of counting along this linear timeline for billions of years. And that's just how time is unfolding. And, you know, in the book, as I'm looking at now, I'm looking at the nature of time. This is a very dominant view that we have. But it isn't shared by all cultures, actually. There are cultures out there that have no sense of abstract linear time at all. They just have now what they experience and what they know in the moment. And if you think about the way that we experience our lives, we only ever experience the past through what we know now. You know, we discover things about the past, you know, in the present moment, if that makes sense. Right. You know, like the Big Bang, for example, you know, we weren't there to see it. The Big Bang becomes a thing because of experiments we do and information that we gain in the now as we're doing science. And it may be that in the future we'll do more experiments and get different information, and we'll change our ideas and realize that the Big Bang didn't happen after all, and something, it was something else. You know, it's all, everything about the past is a model or a belief that we're basing on the information that we have now. So in a way, you could say that, well, that's just exactly the same as what we're seeing in quantum physics, really.
I've got to ask you, Joe, when you first came across these ideas, how did it change you? Because I think
the delayed choice experiment, it was one of those things where there's something that is so mysterious, and you're thinking, well, that's a result. I can't argue with the result. What on earth does that mean? And it just opens a little door that you're thinking, well, wait a minute. I just thought that there's this, you know, I'm living in the physical world, and we're all ticking along in time, and the past is set. You can't change the past. And then suddenly there's this result that's like sticking out and saying that doesn't fit. So I just was really intrigued for a long time, and then I just very confused. Like, what is going on? But actually, talking to physicists, and there are quantum physicists now. So this was a few decades ago that John Wheeler suggested this. He's not with us anymore. But there are quantum physicists now who are working on interpretations that are inspired by him. So talking to them, it was just really fascinating, and I found it really freeing, actually, because you realize that there are so many different ways in which physicists see reality. You know, you've got many worlds where this is the idea that literally the universe is splitting with every interaction that happens, and it's splitting and splitting and splitting and splitting until you've got countless numbers of universes and versions of us, and everything that could possibly happen literally actually happens. And then at the other extreme, you've got this group of physicists inspired by Wheeler. They call themselves cubists. So
that was an interesting part of your book, and I had not. Let's talk about that. Bruno Di Finetti, I think, is the person who starts this. Cubism, it's spelled QBISM, and they are called cubists. This is often seen, and you write this in the book, as an extreme brand of physics.
I love that there's an extreme brand of physics, and I love that there's just so many interpretations. You can literally pick the one that fits your philosophy.
But wait a minute. Did you come across the physics first or the philosophy? Or did the physics cause the philosophy?
I came into now because I'm interested in links between mind and body and consciousness in the physical world, and how do we relate to the physical world, and if there's a, you know, the conventional view is that there's this sort of solid physical reality landscape world out there, and then what is our consciousness then? Is it some kind of floating bubble, and how do our decisions affect what actually really happens? So I came at it interested in that, and then looking at different physics to see how is physics making sense of this? And you realize how many different ways of looking at the world there are. And I like cubism. I mean, I have no idea. I couldn't tell you the secret of reality and who is actually right. But I personally like it because it gives you a way of thinking about reality where mind and body aren't separate, but they're basically part of the same thing, where we are part of helping to create the physical world as we go through our decisions and our actions. And I think that's a really nice way of looking at the world. The cubists have kind of developed John Wheeler's ideas, and they take these results of quantum physics seriously. So rather than saying, how can we explain quantum physics away? How can we come up with a solid physical landscape that we have nothing to do with and we can't change, but still somehow explain these results? They're saying, well, no, these results are telling us that we are part of the world, that the decisions we make and the things we measure and how we choose to measure and the questions we ask seems to make a difference to the answers we get. So they conclude that we are co-creators, is the word that they use, that we are all working together to help create reality in every moment. So the things that we do and the questions we ask and things that we measure actually matter to what happens next. And I think that that's a you know, really nice. I find it really refreshing that you can think of physics in that way.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight returning is science writer Jo Marchant, PhD. We're talking about her new book, In Search of Now, The Science of the Present Moment. So, getting back to cubism, what does that mean for now? Is now real?
Yes. So in cubism, now is kind of the only thing that's real. Like, past and future are useful concepts, but all the stuff, all the decisions, all the happening is happening now. So in the conventional view of physics, so this comes from Einstein and his relativity theory, there's this view of the universe that's called the block universe, where the universe is essentially this static block of space-time. So four-dimensional block, three dimensions of space, one of time. It's just sitting there like a brick, and all of the events of the universe are just there. And relativity says that there's no happening in this universe. You know, events, past, present, future, it makes no difference. It depends how you're looking at it. But everything is just there already written. There was one physicist called Max Tegmark who said that if life is like watching a movie, the block universe is like the DVD. So all kinds of drama and story might unfold for us as we watch the movie, but the block universe is the physical DVD. That is not changing in any way. All the events, all the story is just there. There's no unfolding. There's no happening. There's no choices. Everything is already written. So now is, in this view, now is in how we look at the DVD. So you can watch the story, but you can't rewrite the ending. You can't make a decision halfway through and decide the film is going to end differently. So that's the more conventional block universe view. And what the cubists say is, no, we're throwing out the DVD. There is no DVD. There's no one solid landscape, no one reality that works for everyone. Instead, you've got these perspectives, if you like, these agents like us who are making decisions, who are working together, and so everything in the way that you look in the universe, your perspective, your beliefs, is part of reality. It's helping to determine what exists. So when you're asking questions, when you're measuring things, when you're sensing what's around you, that's all helping to decide the next moment of what happens. So now becomes crucial because that's where all the decisions are being made. There's a metaphor for that as well I can give you if you like.
Which I'm always up for a good metaphor. Go for it.
So rather than the block universe is like, yep, so that's the DVD. It's a physical DVD. It's just sitting there. You can watch it if you want, but you can't change it. Nothing's going to change. The cubist universe, I would say, is more like jazz improvisation, where we're all jazz musicians improvising together. So, you know, we're not, if you think about a jazz trio, they're not all imagining it. They're not all in their own completely separate worlds. They are interacting and they're working, you know, there's some kind of predictable structure there, but it's not set in stone. Like, none of them is going to know kind of what the next note is going to be until they all come together and play it.
I totally get that. Okay, I understand that. Does this mean that
it's not made up or imagined, but it's also not set in stone in advance? So each moment of the universe is like the next moment in a jazz improvisation. But there is structure, and we can make predictions about what might be happening next. But you can't know. You have to play the notes. You have to come together and interact, and that is when the next moment will happen. And so that's more the cubist view of reality.
So is reality just a vast collection of points of view?
They would say so.
Do you feel that that's true? Well, not true. Do you believe that?
Well, it's the points of view, but it's also, and sorry, the cubists would probably say this as well, it's also it's like the probabilistic structure. It's kind of like a meshwork of rules that hold you together. Like with a jazz improvisation, it's the notes, but it's not just the notes. There's a there's a structure there that's tying them together. Does that make sense? There's
a kind of history
of jazz and how jazz has evolved and the different ways that people have played jazz in the past. And there's the history of each of those players and the influences that they've had, their experiences of playing jazz, and also the history of that particular piece, you know, how that improvisation, how that piece they're playing has evolved. So all of that is, there's a kind of a structure there that's all helping to determine what the next note is going to be, rather than it all just being, you know, with a trio, it's not just three, you can't just say it's just the three perspectives. Does that make sense? There's a kind of, there's that structure that, and that history that's holding them together, and that's also part of that reality. And Cubists would say it's the same for the universe, that you've got the perspectives, but there's also the rules of the game. There's a common structure there. There's certain rules, certain probabilities that we all have to abide by that tie us together, or else quantum physics wouldn't work at all. And so what they're interested in is trying to get at that. So if you think about a photon wouldn't be a solid marble. A photon is more like a note that's being played. So it's real. The note exists, but it's more ephemeral than you might think of. You know, it's something that, you know, you play the note and you can observe the note and perceive the note, and then it's gone. But it wasn't there until you played it, and then you're on to the next moment and you're playing the next note. But the Cubists are interested in, well, what is that structure that holds us all together, that's tying all of these probabilities together so that we can make sense of the world? So it would be a bit like the rules that underlie jazz. There's no hard and fast rules.
No.
But there's something, right? Like, else it would just be a complete mess. It would be chaos.
Well, there are jazz bands that are a complete mess. I mean, they've made that choice to, that's the way they're going to do it.
Yeah. Well, it's not like a hard and fast, there's not like 100% rule you have to do. So the Cubists actually say there are no rules, literally no rules whatsoever. You can do anything you want. There is nothing that ties you to saying any particular thing. And, you know, so that your perceptions are, you know, you can make these predictions, but they would say the predictions of quantum physics are essentially personal beliefs. And you can pretty, your own beliefs have to tie together, but you can pretty much just, you know, believe anything you want.
Well, okay, but we're going to run out of time, unfortunately. And okay. I knew that we were going to do that. All these insights, and there's a lot more, by the way, I want to mention in the book. We haven't talked about Alicia Jawaro and context changes everything. And emerging complexity. There's a lot of other ideas in this book. What do these insights matter for how we live day to day as a person?
I think for me, it means that now this moment matters, and rather than everything, you know, so you've got the free will of question, obviously. So rather than everything being decided in advance, you know, I do believe that we have something to bring to each moment. You know, you can't do literally anything you want, but the decisions that you make, what you pay attention to, matters for what comes into existence, for what happens next. And throughout the whole book, the message I was getting all the way through, from psychology, neuroscience, cognitive science, anthropology, ecology, physics, didn't matter where I looked, what you perceive in each moment, it's as much about you and how you're looking as it is about the world. So now isn't just, you know, what shows up to you. It's not just reality showing up to you. It's you showing up to the world. It's how you are going to approach that moment and what you're going to pay attention to. And I think that that's quite empowering, that it gives us a real role to play. Well, whatever you think about the physics, that's up for grabs. Physicists are arguing about that. It's your favorite theory, and I have mine. But even from the psychology, neuroscience point of view as well, it's what you're bringing to the world in each moment. Like, we have so much more say and agency than you would think in the way that we perceive reality. And I think that's what I really took away from it.
I find it interesting, at the very end of the book, you write about the Buddhist priest Dogen. Is that how you pronounce his name?
Because
it's funny, because as I got towards the end of the book, I really started thinking about Zen and how that relates to this. Talk to me about, we just have a couple of minutes, who was Dogen?
Well, he was a Zen Buddhist monk, and he wrote about a concept called being time, essentially. So he talked about time as not clock time, not this linear tick, 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 but being time. I mean, it's notoriously difficult to understand because it's so different from our Western way of being, of seeing the world. But what I took from it was, it's this flow of experience, this lived time, this flow
right,
of moment.
Right.
And he talked about the whole universe coming into being in afresh in every moment. And so all living creatures coming together in every moment to create reality. And that happening again and again and again. So it's all being connected. And so the, you know, I doubt he was talking about particles, but, you know, it's particles, stars, galaxies, everything that you perceive in the universe and everything that every living creature perceives as being tied together. So you do have, so time exists, but it's not ticking seconds. It's this, these experience moments that are all linked together and all leading from one to the next, and the universe being created afresh within each one. And I was just really struck by how that resonated with some of the ideas Wheeler and the Cubists. And I just think it's a really beautiful way of looking at creation and looking at the world.
We're completely out of time. just sounded so weird. My guest tonight, and she's been returning, we've been continuing to talk about her book, is science writer Jo Marchant, PhD. We've been talking about her book. There's a tremendous awful lot in this book, In Search of Now, The Science of the Present Moment. Jo, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much. It's been lovely to talk to you, and thank you for having me back.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.